Hello and welcome to this Short Fiction Masterclass brought to you by Thresholds, the International Short Story Forum in collaboration with the Charleston Trust. My name's Jack Catania and I'm at the Small Wonder Festival talking to the acclaimed writer Michelle Faber, who's here to perform with the sound artist Andrew Lyles. Michelle's latest novel, The Book of Strange New Things, has just been published. Today we'll be discussing his anthology, The Fahrenheit Twins, beginning with the title story.
At the icy zenith of the world, far away from any other children, Tainter Lilith and Micah Caine knew no better than that life was bliss. Therefore, it was bliss. Certainly they had plenty of space to play around in, virtually unlimited space. All around their house, acres of tundra extended in all directions, unpunctuated by fences, roads, or other dwellings. A team of huskies could easily pull a sled with the little bodies of Tainter Lilith and Micah Caine on it for miles without even losing the frisk in their step. Time was also no problem. In almost perpetual Arctic twilight, there weren't any rules about being back by sunset. The only thing the children's mother absolutely insisted on was that they never leave the house without a compass, since the tundra looked much the same in all directions, especially when the snows were fresh. During the darker months, even the uncannily keen vision of the Fahrenheit twins was strained by the gloom, and navigation by the light of the moon on a sea of grey snow was impossible. Still, however dark and treacherous, all that they surveyed was their domain. Nominally, the island of Ostrov Providenia was part of an archipelago that belonged to the Russians, but in reality, no law extended far enough to include this barren wasteland, encircled by a shifting morass of ice. The Fahrenheits were monarchs here, and their two children, prince and princess. "What lies beyond?" the twins once asked their father. "Nothing special," Boris Fahrenheit replied, without looking up from his journals. "What lies beyond?" they then asked their mother, knowing she tended to see things rather differently. "Oh, darlings, too much to explain," she teased. "You'll see it all when you're tired of this little paradise." And she ruffled their unwashed hair in that distantly affectionate way she had. Physically, there was little in common between parents and offspring. Boris Fahrenheit was a tall, thin German, grey of face and silver of hair, walking always slightly stooped, as if the weight of his oversized knitted pullovers was too much for his skeletal frame to bear. Una was also tall, a blue-eyed, rosy-cheeked Aryan beauty, with dyed black hair cut short in a between-the-wars style. She walked erect, keeping all the flesh firm. She was 59 years old, and had produced her children well past the age where such things were considered feasible. Tainter Lilith and Micah Caine were small, even for their age, which was somewhere between 9 and 11. No one had recorded the birth, and it was now too long ago for Boris and Una to recall the exact date. The children were clearly not adolescent yet, anyway. They tumbled around below the furniture, giggling, rounded with puppy fat. They smelled sweet. They wore, without complaint, the embroidered sealskin jumpsuits sewn together for them by their mother. They conversed with the huskies as equals. Their hair was naturally black, hanging long over their ivory-white faces. Each pair of cheeks was sprinkled with cinnamon freckles, as well as a scattering of tiny puckered scars from a mysterious disease that had thankfully run its course without needing medical attention. Their brown eyes were large, with something of the seal about them, all dark iris and no whites, or so it seemed. They resembled neither their father nor mother, despite the fact that the Fahrenheits were, at the time of the twins' conception, already long exiled from past friends. But Boris and Una had been shaped and coloured by the old world, and their children by a subpolar archipelago, whose glacial contours could not even be mapped.
Thank you. That was wonderful. This is a wonderful story. And I think the phrase, what lies beyond, really captures for me as a reader what I feel when I'm engaging with your work. I read it and I think, what lies beyond? And I think you're taking us into territory where we feel that it's uncharted. We don't know what's going to come next.
I'm flattered that you think so, because that's what I'm actually trying to achieve in all my stuff.
Yeah, it feels that you get us to trust you, we trust you, we go into a story, and then we haven't got a map. And I think that sort of, you as a writer, I feel you really enchant and disturb us in equal measure. So I think quite extraordinary.
In The Crimson Petal and the White, there's a bit where Sugar says to little Sophie, trust me.
Mm.
And that is so integral to not just that story, but my relationship with the reader.
Yeah.
I'm going to take them somewhere they didn't expect.
Yes.
And it may be unsettling.
Yeah.
But I want them to feel that they're in safe hands, that I'm not going to,
and
to
I think that
do something unearned or you know, gratuitously nasty to them.
Yes. I think that's really my experience of and this story sums it up for me, the fact that you're taking us quite beyond anything we've ever experienced before. And I wondered if you could tell me a bit about the inspiration. You mentioned that you've dedicated the story to Panda and Shiro.
Yes.
Who are Panda and Shiro?
The story is in memory of Panda and Shiro, and they were two of our cats.
Mm-hmm.
And Panda was just adorable, lovely, lovely cat, and he got some sort of cat AIDS and died very young. And there is always this thing with an animal of how do you commemorate them? Do you just put them in the bin?
Mm.
Do you bury them and have a little ceremony?
Mm-hmm.
You can't have a conventional funeral because there's no cat relatives.
No.
With animals, there is, we're made to face more nakedly how bereft we are of appropriate ceremony.
Yeah.
And what I was exploring in the Fahrenheit Twins was almost the origin of religion, because these children, their mother abruptly dies and their father is not interested, and they are bizarrely given responsibility for disposing of their mother, and they have to somehow find with their childish instincts a ritual or a ceremony that will be appropriate for disposing of their mother. And that whole thing of where ritual comes from and the way children helplessly invent rituals, I feel that's very close to where religion presumably originally comes from, and that's what I wanted to get at in the Fahrenheit Twins.
Because, of course, their parents are involved in ritual, aren't they? Their parents are anthropologists
who
are looking at local rituals and customs and seemingly not getting very far with it.
Yes.
Whereas the children have invented a ritual of their own to stave off puberty.
Yes.
Where did that idea come from, the idea of blinding the Arctic fox?
Well, I mean, on a narrative, on a sort of myth of logic level, the idea is that if the fox is blinded, then the new day that might bring the onset of puberty will be something the fox never sees, and therefore it won't exist because it's not seen by this talismanic animal. But on another level, it was just instinctive on my part because it's a a story like that which is about people behaving very instinctively and very primally. It's like a permission for me to behave that way as a storyteller. And I do always like to have some weird elements in my story that can't be really explained or
They fit within the logic of the story.
Yeah.
And those elements to me in this story had very mythological, I would say fairy tale, but you know, fairy tale in the darker sense.
Yeah, I think a lot of my stories and my novels are they're like fairy tales or fables.
Mm.
But what confuses people sometimes with a book like Under the Skin or The Crimson Petal is that it's played so realistically.
Yes.
That the fable element of it doesn't yes. seem as overt.
Yeah.
But it's there.
I think so, because you shift us into metaphor, and often you do that through the consciousness of your characters, mm-hmm. so that the character is perceiving the story set in a supermarket. The supermarket detective is actually, he's perceiving things in a kind of a, I would say, legend rather than myth, but a legendary
yeah.
way.
Yes.
You know, he can shoot down people he doesn't like. He can yeah. shoot down his supervisor.
Yeah.
Does the term magical realism, do you identify with that at all, or do you feel that labels are not helpful in understanding what you're trying to do?
I'm sure that labels help people. They don't really help me, because... all the things that I seek out as a consumer are really unclassifiable.
Yeah.
And all the music that I love, it's very difficult to tell, to explain to people, to describe to people what sort of music it is. And because I don't read genre fiction, not because I have contempt for it, but because... A, I don't read very much because I'm listening to music all the time, but B, I'm so fundamentally uneasy with tackling a narrative where I know from the outset what's going to happen.
Yes.
I know it's going to have a murder in it and a detective or whatever. I just, yeah. I can't see the point
yeah.
of journeying through that narrative if I yeah. already know those things. So yes, I want that element of the unclassifiable and the unlabelable.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wanted to ask you about the theme, one of the themes I perceived in the Fahrenheit Twins, and then moving on to the whole collection. There's a sentence, more than anything else, the twins' characters were formed by benign neglect. And the subject of parental nurture seems uh-huh. to emerge a lot in this collection. I know you've talked about it in relationship to The Crimson Petal and yes. the White. I saw it in, you know, Serious Swimmers. Serious Swimmers is a story where a recovering heroin addict takes her son under supervision to the local swimming pool.
Yes.
There's the story All Black, where a gay father is on a coach journey between his lover and the girl's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And everything becomes dark too soon. So, again, you're slipping into the metaphorical, mm-hmm. but it becomes mm-hmm. real. And then, of course, there's the smallest of actions, where a mother literally breaks her baby,
mm-hmm.
and her husband doesn't notice mm-hmm. either the damage to the mother or the baby. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. could you say something about whether you are conscious of themes when you're writing a short story? Obviously, it's something you weave into a longer narrative mm-hmm. like the novel, mm-hmm. but does the theme emerge unexpectedly? Do you notice it in retrospect, or are you aware of it when you're writing?
I'm not aware of it on the level that you just outlined there, in the sense of analysing that each of these stories has sort of common thematic elements. But what I am keenly aware of when I'm putting a collection together is the balance of light and dark, the balance of transcendence and the feel-bad factor, to put it crudely.
There is an element of horror in some of these stories.
There is an element of horror, and when I was putting the Fahrenheit Twins together, I was aware that overall it was a darker collection than Some Rain Must Fall.
Mm.
There's some very horrifying stories in it. Someone to Kiss It Better is very, very grim. And I felt that I owed it to the reader to not bring them down, not make them feel that I was trying to persuade them that life on planet Earth is horrific.
Yeah.
So just before the collection was published, I wrote the story Mouse, which is,
mm-hmm.
it's very lighthearted.
Yeah.
And its humour is very gentle and humane. Mm. And I took care to have the Fahrenheit twins be the final story in the collection, because there is this sense...
They survive the wilderness.
They survive the wilderness, and there is this sense of infinite possibility still. Mm. You know, they're young,
yeah.
and they have their lives ahead of them. I'm very mindful of the tenor of stories and how I want you to feel as a result of having read them. But I don't think in terms of I'm now writing another story in which parental nurture is failing.
Mm.
I can look back and spot that, but I don't
mm.
I don't analyse that at the time.
I didn't see it as failing. I saw it as kind of being called into question.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the harshest of the stories, redemption could be read.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned Someone to Kiss It Better. For him, there's a moment of redemption in that he's crawled back. A murderer has crawled back to his mother's house.
Yeah.
For Someone to Kiss It Better. He seems to be dying.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very dark.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, you don't leave us in a terrible place.
He perceives himself in this transcendent moment, but if we interpret that as what he's going through, as his system is shutting down, some people could see that as the author bemoaning or being horrified by the fact that women will keep giving birth to these men and allowing them to grow up into the sort of men who will do those sorts of things to women.
Abusive things.
So yes, it. I think that's an uncommonly dark story by my standards.
I did have a feeling of when I was reading some of these stories that damage was being done, and at points it became irreparable.
Mm-hmm.
So A Hole at Both Ends, where a couple run down a Scottish wildcat and then look for it and to see if they could save it or finish it off, and the cat attacks them.
Yes.
And there was, I just had this awful sense of damage being completely irreparable at that point in time, both to their relationship.
Yes.
Also to the animal. So that I think for me is the darkest place in the book.
I did actually pull a wildcat out of a hole in the side of the road.
Did you?
So that's one of the few stories of mine that's quite closely based on something I've experienced myself. Usually I make it all up, and I'm much more comfortable with the notion of writers as creators and storytellers than people who are channeling their own experience. Specifically, I mean, I could never write a story about a Dutch kid who
went
to Australia, etc. There's no interesting way into that narrative for me.
And that brings me on to, I suppose, I could link it to the idea of the hallucinatory sense of place, which you evoke in many of your stories. So there is, again, going back to the Fahrenheit twins, there is a sort of sense of the tundra as being an almost physical presence in the story. It's very strong. Even in the more mundane settings, like a dilapidated council estate, you introduce an element of strangeness, of other, in sense of place.
Yes.
You have other stories that are set in places like 19th century Orchester, which again is very heightened in terms of the details that you pick out. Or a conference hotel in Indonesia, which again has a strange sort of hyper-realism to it. Do you experience places having surreal possibilities when you're actually there? So we've talked about how you don't write your own biography into stories. Do you experience places as having this strangeness, or do you heighten them for the purposes of fiction?
I heighten them for the purposes of fiction. I think one thing that a lot of writers are able to draw on is their very strong memories of particular places that were significant to them when they were young. And they keep returning to those. And because my memory is very, very poor, and I lose my earlier years progressively as I get older, more of the earlier years slip into oblivion. I can't call on that. You know, I can't have my James Joyce Dublin or whatever, which just eternally remains vivid in my mind. So I do find that I have to keep inventing or reinventing these locales. And
you do it so vividly.
Thank you. You know, I can't know what sort of writer I would have been if I had a normally functioning memory. It might well be that I wouldn't be imbuing these invented places with that hallucinatory aura. But, you know, we work with what we've got to work with. And
we're certainly the richer for it.
Oh, thank you.
Can we move on to another story in the collection? The first story, The Safe House,
yes,
came second in the inaugural National Short Story Prize in 2006. So this is the prize that later became the BBC Short Story Award. And I was wondering if you would mind reading a section. This is a few pages into the story, but is marked very clearly as being the second section of the story.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The main characters approaching the safe house.
I've never been to the safe house before. Well, never inside it, anyway. I've walked past many times, and I know exactly where to find it. It's on the side of town where all the broken businesses and closed railway stations are, the rusted barbed wire side of town, where everything waits forever to be turned into something new. The safe house is the only building there whose windows have light behind them. Of course I've wondered what goes on inside, I won't deny that. But I've always passed it on the other side of the street, hurried myself on before I could dawdle, pulling myself away as if my own body were a dog on a lead. Today, I don't resist. Wet and emaciated and with my name writ large on my chest, I cross the road to the big grey building. The safe house looks like a cross between a warehouse and school, built in the old-fashioned style, with acres of stone facade and scores of identical windows, all glowing orange and black. In the geometric centre of the building is a fancy entrance with a motto on its portal. "Give me a deine arme," it says, in a dull rainbow of wrought iron. Before I make the final decision, I hang around in front of the building for a while, in case the rain eases off. I walk the entire breadth of the facade, hoping to catch a glimpse of what lies behind it, but the gaps between the safe house and the adjacent buildings are too narrow. I stretch my neck, trying to see inside one of the windows. Well, it feels as if I'm stretching my neck anyway. I know necks don't really stretch, and we're the same height no matter what we do. But that doesn't stop me contorting my chin like an idiot. Eventually I work up the courage to knock at the door. There's no doorbell or door knocker, and in competition with the rain, my knuckles sound feeble against the dense wood. From the inside, the pok 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 of my flesh and bone will probably be mistaken for water down the drain. However, I can't bring myself to knock again until I'm sure no one has heard me. I shift my weight from foot to foot while I'm waiting, feeling warm sweat and rainwater suck at the toes inside my shoes. My T-shirt is so drenched that it's hanging down almost to my knees, and I can read a telephone number that people are supposed to ring if they've seen me. I close my eyes and count to 10. Above my head, I hear the squeak of metal against wood. I look up at the darkening facade, and there, eerily framed in the window nearest to the top of the portal, is a very old woman in a nurse's uniform. She flinches at the rain, and, mindful of her perfectly groomed hair and pastel cottons, stops short of leaning her head out. Instead, she looks down at me from where she stands, half hidden in shadow. "What can we do for you?" she says, guardedly, raising her voice only slightly above the weather. I realize I have no answer for her, no words. Instead, I unwrap my arms from my torso, awkwardly revealing the text on my T-shirt. The sodden smock of white fabric clings to my skin as I lean back, blinking against the rain. The old woman reads carefully, her eyes rolling to and fro in their sockets. When she's finished, she reaches out a pale, bone-wristed hand and takes hold of the window latch. Without speaking, she shuts the dark glass firmly between us and disappears. Moments later, the massive door creaks open and I'm in.
Thank you. For me, that story really encapsulates the way you take the familiar and make it strange. So there are elements of realism in the story, and there are elements of fantasy, really. Mm-hmm. The fact that your main character, your protagonist, is wearing a T-shirt which has all these details on it.
Yes.
And a code at the back. And other people who enter the safe house have the same sort of T-shirt. So by the end of the story, we're in territory which is completely, well, I would say magical realist, where he's in a place which we recognise and we don't recognise. All the details are familiar, but the place itself doesn't exist, or does it? And I'd like you to tell me a bit about that place and the genesis of that story.
It's interesting, this notion of the magical, because there are, of course, especially nowadays in these sort of post-Neil Gaiman times, there are a lot of slipstreamy stories in which daily life shades into the mythical and the fantastical, and people sprout wings and are living in apartment buildings with fairies and whatever. And that's not really what something like the Safe House is doing.
No.
The genesis of the Safe House, I used to get the Big Issue regularly in the days when it really was a magazine for and about the homeless. It's become quite show busy now. And I'm not complaining about that. That's just the decision that they've made. But I used to get it very regularly, and one of the features in it was these little narratives you would get about Jack has been missing since April 2003, and he was last seen wearing this, and he was last known to be doing that.
Yes.
And if anyone has seen him, etc. And you got these very poignant and sometimes heartbreaking little, I don't know, 100-word snapshots of a life that had gone seriously off the rails. And that made me think about how, you know, if you can encapsulate that lost life in such a short text, then it could fit on a T-shirt.
Yes.
So that, I think, gave rise to this notion of these people walking around with their history, the history that had brought them to being homeless, actually written physically on them. And then instinctively I sort of blended that with almost a Auschwitz-Birkenau kind of feel to it, where you don't know why the motto is in German. And
it's quite chilling, actually.
It is quite chilling. I mean, there's a part of Auschwitz where there's a lot of sinks where people were supposed to wash. And there are little illustrations of pussycats washing themselves to encourage cleanliness. And in a context like that, I mean, that is beyond sinister. It is so incredibly creepy. So I was combining those very worrying elements with that real sense of companionship and community that all these lost souls are able to offer each other when they are in this safe house together.
Although there's very little comfort in communication between them.
There is very little comfort. But, you know, on some level, what human beings often forget is that we are animals and that there is some value in being with others of your kind.
Yes.
Even if all you're really doing together is sitting in the same space, keeping warm.
Mm.
But yeah, it is a very dark story. It is very, very sad. But I don't think it's negative in the sense of making you feel cynical about the human race. I think there's just this sense of the critical mass of poignancy in this world.
That's exactly the effect it had on
me. Yeah, so many lost lives and the yearnings and the things that will never be. And I think being able to feel that sympathy, if you like, is in itself positive.
Yes. And that's exactly how the story made me feel. It made me feel a sort of sense of sadness and poignancy as a weight. As a weight, but not something I wanted to reject, something I could enter into and just grief or humanity in a way.
Yeah. I mean, so often with what I've written, I've actually started with wanting to make you feel in a particular way and then having to figure out how to get you there, how to get you feeling that way.
And I wanted to ask you about the voice in The Safe House, because along with All Black, I think they're the only two stories where you've chosen to write it in the first person. And I wondered what it was that made you make that choice.
I think that's instinctive, so I don't know that I have an answer for you. But I think in my third-person stories, I feel free to describe things which the central character wouldn't necessarily note.
Yes.
But the animating spirit in the story tends to be of the person that it's mainly about.
Yeah.
So even if it is technically third person, there is very much a personality imbuing it. But I guess there are some stories where I already know that I'm not going to need to be evoking or describing anything that the eye in the story wouldn't see or feel.
Mm.
And in that case, it's stronger to make it first person.
Yeah. So I think I wanted to ask you a little bit about character in general. Would you agree that many of your characters are marginalised in some way? I feel that often they're operating on the edge of things. Looking in or looking out, but from the edges.
Yes. I mean, I always have been a fringe dweller, but it's interesting that this novel that's coming out soon, The Book of Strange New Things, that the character in that, both characters in that, the man and wife, they're much more connected and less marginalised, more part of a functional community of people, and very much in love and with a very sound relationship, which of course in a lot of my work people can't manage.
Yes.
And I think on some level that was me acknowledging that I've done quite enough marginalised characters and that it was time to firstly explore something else and also pay proper homage to the fact that you know, I was married for 26 years to someone that I really loved and that really worked.
Yes.
And I was uneasy about the fact that in toto my work might seem to add up to an argument that people just can't get it together.
Mm.
They can't really communicate. They can't figure out how to love each other. So I'm glad that I have
yes
redressed that a bit. But, you know, the earlier work remains and is very heavily weighted to what you've described.
I think for me, a marginal character is also somebody who can observe and someone who has a sense of life that is much more heightened
yes
than somebody who is moving along with the mainstream. So I didn't see it as a negative thing necessarily. Mm. And I think that certainly in this short story collection, though there are dark moments, there are also many characters reaching for each other.
Yeah.
The father and the daughter, for example, and that mm-hmm. journey, mm-hmm. there's a strong sense of a bond that we hope will remain, mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. though we don't know mm-hmm. that it mm-hmm. will. Do you find that those characters who inhabit your stories and your novels, do you find that they are the starting point of those stories? Do you find you have different starting points for your stories?
I never start with character. I, as I was saying a minute ago, I start with states of being yep. that I want to evoke. And I then have to find both the narrative and the characters that will achieve that. But that's not in a rigorous schematic way.
Mm.
It all happens quite organically. But yeah. I'm aware that the feeling is coming first, and the story and the character at some time later. Yeah.
And I think my final question is about length or form, because we've been talking about the short story collection and. You've been quoted as saying, each book lets me know at the outset how long it wants and needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if any of these stories could have been novels, if they have the potential to be novels, if you feel radically different when you start writing a short story. Do you know it's going to be a short story? Or is that something you also feel your way into?
It's something I feel my way into. And I do find sometimes when I read a novel that's 300 pages long, that really what it ought to have been is a 55-page story, and that the reason why it was not a 55-page story is that there is nowhere in this world, in the current publishing climate, where you can publish a 55-page story.
Yes.
You know, it can't be a standalone, it can't be entered into competitions,
mm.
there is no magazine that will run anything that long, and I think that sort of consideration actually makes a lot of writers artificially pump up
yeah.
a narrative so that it is longer. And by the same token, I think that there are some stories which the authors keep within 3,000 words because they want to enter them into competitions,
yes.
and 3,000
yes.
words tends to be the cutoff. And, you know, some stories really could have done with being
longer
and breathing more. But they were sort of savagely edited for non-literary reasons. And, yeah, I still stand by that earlier statement about each thing determining how long it needs to be. And when I put out the Courage Consort and the 199 Steps in the USA, they said that Americans are not reading novellas right now, so we want to put them together into an anthology, and we want to put a third novella in there. Do you have anything? So I gave them the Fahrenheit Twins, so it was this sort of omnibus. And I think that, well, that's a shame. I think that it would be nice to live in a world where a standalone volume could be published with a 55-page story in it, and that it would just be cheap. They would just adjust the price so that you didn't feel you were paying a lot of money for a small amount of text. But the world is what it is, and short story competitions are what they are, and I understand that if people want to be published, then they have to keep within those constraints. But I'm fortunate in that I've had a very loyal publisher, and when I've been putting together collections of short stories, I haven't had to worry about the word count.
Yes.
I edit them to what they need to be,
yeah,
and that's what they
that's
are.
That's the story. Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your talking to us, and you've been very generous with your insights about your work, but also with your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure.